This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello and welcome to the Back to Movement podcast. I'm your host, Bernadette, and today I'm joined by Dr. Peter Derman, a minimally invasive and endoscopic spine surgeon at Texas Back Institute. Back pain is one of the most common reasons people seek medical care, and for many, surgery feels like the last resort. But when is it truly the right choice? How do you know if surgery is necessary or if other treatments might be just as effective? Dr. Derman, thank you so much for accepting my invitation and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Now, can you tell us your story? How did you go from being a gymnast to being an orthopedic surgeon?
Yeah, it was kind of a natural transition. So I started gymnastics when I was 5 years old and competed all the way up through college. I was the captain of the team at Stanford. And gymnastics really informed who I am today. So I think about my life in two phases. I was a gymnast and now I'm a spine surgeon. And a lot of the preparation and skills that I learned as a gymnast have really translated nicely. I think as a gymnast, as a high level athlete, you get unfortunately exposed to a lot of doctors because there's injuries and such. And I was always impressed by the doctors who could, you know, get us back in the game. And so when it came time to be done with my gymnastics career, it was a natural transition to think about medicine and being able to give that back to other people.
Nice. Now, did you have any injuries?
Yeah, so fortunately, I didn't have any big injuries. Mm-hmm. So gymnastics is pretty hard on your body. And I was the only one in college, I believe, who didn't have surgery. Mm-hmm. We had some pretty big injuries. Fortunately, no catastrophic injuries, but, you know, spinal fractures, femur fractures, knee dislocation, kind of big stuff. Fortunately, other than some wear and tear, I was fine and didn't end up needing surgery. But, you know, I still do my physical therapy actually from college. So rings was my big event and it was hard on my shoulders. And I still do the PT exercises that I learned, you know, way back then, and it keeps me out of trouble.
What's your favorite exercise?
So rings was my big event in gymnastics. And by the end of my career, I was a ring specialist. So I was doing rings all the time. I was a lot bigger back then. Now I'm just a shriveled shadow of my former self. But as a result, I really like TRX. So the suspension trainers, because it speaks to the way that I used to exercise.
Yeah, it's very similar. Mm-hmm. Has some similarities. Yeah,
it does.
Yeah, love it. Now, Dr. Derman, I really wanted to ask you this question. A couple months ago, I asked my primary care doctor what they do for patients with low back pain. And she said they quickly refer them to a specialist because they can't prescribe strong medications. Given that primary care doctors should follow clinical guidelines, what is your view on this?
Well, the clinical guidelines say that strong medications should not be prescribed. So everything suggests that for chronic low back pain, which means back pain that's been present for 3 or more months, narcotics or other type of strong medications are not the answer. And in fact, spine surgery is almost never the answer for those patients either. It's really about finding a good constellation of non-surgical things that can help them with their back pain, which is usually a combination of physical therapy and other therapeutic type exercise. Sometimes chiropractic can fit into that mix. Non-narcotic type medications, such as anti-inflammatory type medications, if there's no medical reason that they can't take them. Exercise, weight loss, avoiding things like smoking, which we know is bad for your spine and can cause pain. And then in some instances, injection-based modalities can be helpful as well.
So do you think that many doctors don't really follow the clinical guidelines when it comes to back pain?
Unfortunately, I think that's the case. And there's probably a few reasons for that. You know, maybe they're not kind of up to date on the latest research. And then, you know, you have a patient in front of you, and I want to give those doctors the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they think they're helping that patient, but things like narcotic type medication for back pain, it's really a slippery slope. And for a lot of patients, it can kind of get them into a worse problem.
Yeah. I've got the clinical practice guidelines. It is from 2018, and they definitely don't recommend for non-specific low back pain. The clinical practice guidelines recommend physical examination to identify red flags, cauda equina, fracture. For treatments of patients with acute low back pain, the guidelines recommend reassurance on the favorable prognosis and advice on returning to normal activities, reducing or avoiding bed rest.
Yeah, that's important. So bed rest used to be prescribed. And no. I never tell people to have bed rest.
It still does in Hungary, where I'm from. They usually say, oh, just stay in bed and just do nothing.
That creates all kinds of additional issues. I mean, in the acute phase, when people throw out their back, frequently they can't move. So it's not, we can't expect them to like go for a run. But once they start to feel a little bit better, the more motion they can tolerate, the better. And very rarely, even though it can be painful, does that activity cause additional problems?
And of course, the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, as you mentioned. Yes, so definitely, I do believe that some doctors, unfortunately, they straight away send their patients to the specialist, which is not necessarily, they don't mean anything bad, but that's probably not the best thing to do.
Really, when I see those patients, I give them reassurance. We give them an anti-inflammatory and we send them to physical therapy because that's usually all they need. And even though these episodes of pain can sometimes, especially acute low back pain, can be very severe, and they think like, oh my gosh, something is horribly wrong. Like I need an operation or something like that. The amount of pain they're experiencing is not necessarily a marker of the severity of the problem. And almost always within a couple of days to a couple of weeks, their pain subsides and they go back to being who they are. And getting them back to movement is probably the best way of preventing future episodes from occurring.
I think people believe that pain equals tissue damage, but that's not the case, as we know.
No. Yeah. And so I want them to move. That's really the key to getting them out of that acute phase and preventing or minimizing at least future episodes. So actually rarely is surgery for back pain, which is kind of a surprising thing. Like I'm a back and a neck doctor, surgeon, and I almost never, with very few exceptions, operate for back pain or neck pain. Really, the surgeries that we do are most useful and predictably beneficial for pinched nerves, which cause not neck and back pain really, but arm pain and sciatica down the leg. So you hear people say, oh, my aunt had back surgery, her back still hurts, or she was never better, or this and that. My neighbor had back surgery, he's still on narcotics for back pain. And unfortunately, when back or neck surgery is done for the wrong reason, it's not as effective. So we talk about 50% chance of 50% relief with surgery for back pain. That's abysmal. If I'm doing a 50% job, that's a, like, I need to do something else, do something better. But the results of back surgery for sciatica are dramatically better. I mean, we're talking about 95% of people are dramatically better with respect to their pain shooting down their leg. So the vast majority of the surgeries I'm doing is actually to relieve pressure on nerves. And those patients are so thankful and so grateful because they often feel better immediately afterwards.
Now, can we talk about a little bit more about sciatic nerve pain? Mm-hmm. Where does it come from? Can you explain that?
So if we're talking about sciatica, meaning pain running down the leg, it's usually coming from a pinched nerve in the mm-hmm. low back. And that pinching of the nerve can occur for a couple of different reasons. So the most common of which, there's probably two common reasons, and they kind of go with some age groups, right? So in the younger population, and let's just say 50 years of age and below, usually sciatica is coming from a disc bulge in the mm-hmm. back, so a herniated disc. So there's the bones of the spine, mm-hmm. and then there's the discs in between, mm-hmm. and the discs are like rubbery shock absorbers, basically. And in some people, they get some wear and tear in those discs, and sometimes even young people, and a piece can bulge or even mm-hmm. break off. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it pushes on the nerves, which mm-hmm. are immediately behind the discs. And those nerves go down the mm-hmm. legs, and that causes sciatica down the leg. The other kind of group of people are generally a little bit older. So usually, you know, in their 50s mm-hmm. or beyond, although there's a lot of overlap here. And they get arthritis in their spine. And that arthritis is wear and tear in the joints in the back of the spine, which can create bone spurs and overgrowth mm-hmm. of this soft tissue called ligamentum flavum. And that tends to take up space for those nerves too. And that can cause sciatica down the leg as well. And some people have a combination of two. But when that happens, they get that mm-hmm. that shooting pain down their leg. And that's where if all of the non-surgical things fail, we can very reliably give them relief of that mm-hmm. kind of pain.
Yes, because disc herniation has a natural history, right? 12 to 18 months, usually they heal without doing anything.
That's
Am I
true.
Correct?
That's absolutely true. So what I tell my patients is 80% of people with a disc herniation and associated sciatica will get better without surgery. So the pain, as we talked about, just like the back pain can be severe, the leg pain can mm-hmm. be very severe. Mm-hmm. And many times they come to my office begging me for me just to do an operation mm-hmm, on mm-hmm, them. Mm-hmm. But I just treat everyone like my own family. And, you know, while while I do all these ultra minimally invasive surgeries, and we can talk about that, the least invasive surgery is still no surgery at all. And if I'm operating on everyone who comes to me with sciatica, and 80% of them will get better without surgery, that means I'm doing 80% too much mm-hmm, surgery. Mm-hmm. So what we do, the hard part is it's difficult to predict who are those 20% mm-hmm, who will need mm-hmm, surgery. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we just work them through the process. We start with the most conservative things, physical therapy, non-narcotic medications, injections if deemed necessary. Mm-hmm. And if their symptoms persist, then we think about something mm-hmm. from a surgical perspective.
Do you wait 12 to 18 months or they usually...
It depends on a couple of things. It depends on the severity of their symptoms, mm-hmm. and it depends on the overall trend. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody is in excruciating pain and they can't put their shoes on mm-hmm. and, you know, they can't take care of their mm-hmm. family, they can't go to work, mm-hmm. you know, and it's been a reasonable amount of time and they're just not getting better despite these mm-hmm. things. Or in infrequent instances where there's legitimate concern for neurologic damage, nerve damage, mm-hmm. right? Things like cauda equina syndrome, which is very severe compression of the nerves. Or if people have substantial weakness in their leg. Mm-hmm. So pain, while I'm very empathetic to pain, there's not really a timeline on pain. Mm-hmm. And so if they're starting to get better, if there's other things we can do, if we can temporize things enough, then we can make that pain go away. And if surgery is indicated, if it's 8 months from now, I can make that pain go away. But if somebody has a severe weakness, mm-hmm. a foot drop, something like mm-hmm. that, there mm-hmm. is a more of a timeline on that. And those people can skip the line a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I'm more apt to recommend or at least offer them a surgery earlier on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And how do you decide if someone with back pain really needs the surgery?
Right. So it's about the amount of pain and the trend. And so if it's tolerable and it's getting better, we can wait it out, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what I tell them is, hey, you know, if you look back and you're better than you were a month ago, mm-hmm, a month mm-hmm. from now, you might be even mm-hmm. better. And I've seen very impressive MRIs with people with a giant disc herniation who feel better without surgery and then get another MRI for some reason later on, say they were in a fender bender, and that disc herniation is gone. Like completely gone, and we did not do surgery. And so if we can stall long mm-hmm. enough, And it's tolerable enough to the patient, then we don't do surgery. But if we've tried these other things and their symptoms are not getting better, mm-hmm. not getting fast enough, that's where we think about surgical intervention.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, you know, sometimes surgery is recommended too soon?
Yeah, I think so, unfortunately. For me, I just treat everyone like my own family member. Mm-hmm. And you think about what you do for your mother or your sister mm-hmm. or something like that. And it helps guide you in the right direction. For instance, my neighbor down the street, he was having some sciatica, very severe sciatica. Mm-hmm. He almost went to the emergency room and mm-hmm. things like that. And he was begging me just to put him on the table and operate mm-hmm. on him. And I kind of talked him down. And actually, my wife saw him yesterday, and he's doing phenomenally well. Mm-hmm. No surgery whatsoever. And so if we can get people over this initial mm-hmm. hump, and then they do well. And mm-hmm. some people say like, oh, I don't want to do X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have an injection because that's just a Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. It's not fixing the underlying yeah. problem. But if we can give them a Band-Aid that's a little bit good mm-hmm. enough for long enough, mm-hmm. then their body might do the rest and they might not need something else.
Exactly.
And that's where injections come into play. And then physical therapy and physical activity for helping them kind of prevent future issues.
Yeah. What are some red flags that a patient might be pushed into surgery prematurely?
Yeah, not giving them the multitude of options, right? So I always have a conversation with my patients. I don't walk into the room knowing, hey, this is going to be the outcome of this. I explain the situation. We talk about the options. And so, you know, if a surgeon just walks into the room and says, hey, this is the surgery mm-hmm. that you need, without, you know, talking through the other options. And maybe those options aren't good, right? Like maybe this person does have a severe foot drop and surgery is the right thing. But at least being explained why surgery is the mm-hmm. answer makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And then anyone that's pressured into surgery, you know, we're not used car salesmen. My job, I feel like I'm like the waiter, right? I bring the menu. I talk about the specials.
Options.
The options, the pros and cons. And then I help that patient. We have shared decision making, mm-hmm. figure out what's the right thing. And so if you ever feel pressured, you should always get a second opinion. You know, I often feel like patients sometimes do more research on their choice of television than their choice of spine surgeon. And just because this person's wearing a white coat doesn't mean mm-hmm. that we're all the same. Mm-hmm. And so I'm never insulted when my patients want to get a second opinion. I want them to feel totally comfortable with what they do. And I provide a lot of second opinions too. So people shouldn't feel bashful about that. And if you're at a surgeon's office and they get insulted mm-hmm. by your desire for another opinion, that's another red flag mm-hmm. too.
That's a red flag. Okay, thank you. What role does imaging play in deciding on surgery?
Yeah, so, and that brings up the question, like, how do we decide who is mm-hmm, a surgical mm-hmm, candidate? Mm-hmm. And it's a combination of things. So it's what the patient tells you. So you mm-hmm. have to sit down and listen mm-hmm. to your patients and hear them out and learn about the symptoms that they're having and how it impacts their quality of life. You have to physically examine the patient. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do their reflexes. We test their strength. I see how they walk. Like, that's really important because it's amazing how many people think they have a spine problem. Turns out they've had a hip problem all the time. Mm-hmm. And they've spent the last 2 years getting spine interventions when all they needed is something to do with their hip. So if you don't touch the patient and examine them, mm-hmm. you'll never know that. Right? That's the second thing. And then imaging, to your question, is the next thing that I look at. And so even before I look at their imaging, in talking to them and in examining them, I'm trying to figure out where this is coming from. And then I try to find that problem on the imaging. Because if you MRI people off the street, they've done studies. If you MRI any random non-symptomatic person off the street, if you're 40 years old or older, you have all kinds of stuff on your MRI. But that doesn't mean that it's causing you any problem. Mm-hmm. So the danger is starting with the imaging, because you can justify all kinds of things which may not even be relevant to the patient. So what I'm trying to do, and what I think is really fascinating about spine surgery, is every patient's a puzzle. And I'm trying to amalgamate all of this evidence and data to figure out exactly where that mm-hmm. problem's coming from, so that if it does come to surgery, I can develop really the most focused plan to address that problem. You know, you see some people with like big scoliosis and arthritis up and down their spine and pinching of nerves, stenosis here and there. But really, if you're thoughtful about it, you can often find one little spot that's the crux of their problem and create an intervention that just addresses that rather than some massive surgery that's going to, you know, have really negative ramifications for them.
Yeah, because many people with scoliosis have no pain. And
that's
many
right.
people walking around with this herniation, this degeneration, and
they don't even know it.
They don't even know it because they don't have an MRI.
That's right.
Back.
That's so, right.
Perfect. Now, how do procedures like discectomy, spinal fusion, and artificial disc replacement differ? Can you?
Yeah. So I guess if it comes to surgery, my goal is to create the least invasive surgery that exists that preserves the patient's ability to be active and have a quality of life. And a lot of that is about preserving motion. And so discectomy, which you referred to, that means going in and cleaning out. So there's a variety of different procedures that fall under that. We call them decompression. So discectomy, laminectomy, foraminotomy, all of these are cleanout type procedures, like a Roto-Rooter. So there's no like device that's placed in the patient. And those are most effective for nerve compression type symptoms, which is that sciatica that we talked about, or sometimes something called neurogenic claudication, which often happens in older people when they get compression of the nerves. They get heaviness and discomfort in their legs, especially with standing for periods of time or walking distances. That's usually better when they lean forward or when they sit down. So they find that their ability to walk distances, that distance decreases over time, and they're looking for somewhere to sit. Or at a very classic thing is called the shopping cart sign, which they lean forward on a shopping cart at the grocery store. And that leaning forward opens up a little space for their nerves and lets them walk further. So both the discectomy type patients, sciatica type patients, and the stenosis neurogenic claudication patients, they frequently benefit from these clean out type procedures, which are usually the least invasive type procedures. And the way that I do them, patients come and go the same day. And there's a variety of different techniques for doing them. So if I can just clean someone out, then that's the best, right? There are a variety of reasons that sometimes people aren't a candidate for those. For instance, if they have instability in their spine. So if their nerves are being pinched, and part of the reason for that pinching is because their bones are sliding around. Well, I can clean that out as much as I want, but the bones are still going to slide around. And so those patients often need stabilization, right? What they what they lack is stability in their spine. And sometimes those people do need like a fusion type operation. Now fusion's like a four letter word. I think it's six letters, but it starts with an F, right? So nobody wants a fusion, and fusion's actually the last choice for me when developing a surgical plan. Although in some cases it is necessary to allow people to have the relief that they need. And the key to having patients do really well with fusion is one, being thoughtful and really thinking about if you can minimize the number of levels fused. And then two, there are a variety of different ways of getting a fusion done. So there are minimally invasive ways of doing this. Now, minimally invasive spine surgery, we haven't really touched on this, but it's not just about the size of the incision. Although I pride myself on making like the smallest incisions around, it's like my calling card. But really what happens under the skin is far more important. And that's preserving the muscles and ligaments and other soft tissue structures. So the traditional spine surgery is a big incision down the center of the spine and then literally burning and stripping the muscles off the side of the spine.
Now, how do you do an anterior? Do you do the anterior lumbar interbody fusion?
I do. Yeah? I do.
And so do you operate through the abdominis?
From the front, which sounds crazy. And when I tell patients about this, they're like, oh my gosh, my spine's in the back. Why are you going from the front? But really the goal is to access the spine through a number of portals that allow you to get there without disrupting the muscle. Because if you do it all from the back, frequently you have to destroy that muscle. And as you know, that muscle is so important for keeping people mobile and upright. And so, you know, there's a variety of techniques going from the front or the side or diagonal, which allow us to access the spine. I think about it like a ship in a bottle. I can access the spine through a number of little openings, which allow me to create the ship without destroying the model. Mm-hmm. The reason that going from the front is often a good option is because we just go between the abs. Mm-hmm. So we're not cutting the muscle. Mm-hmm. And as a result, people bounce back really nicely from surgery like that.
But there are like the vena cava and other things there. So what happens if accidentally you touch it or snap it or, you know?
Right. So there's risks of everything, mm-hmm. right? And we're balancing those risks. So with surgery from the front in particular, here in the United States, most spine surgeons do that surgery with what we call an approach surgeon. So this is a surgeon who's usually either a general surgeon or a vascular surgeon, and we operate right across from each other. Mm-hmm. So the approach surgeon safely gets me down to the spine, protects those important structures while I do the spine work. Mm-hmm. And as a result, if you're selective on who you do this on, mm-hmm. on the patients, and there are a variety of patients that maybe aren't a great candidate for this, but there's a workup that we do. But if you select patients appropriately, it's a very safe way of getting mm-hmm. this done.
Do you like have a guideline if, for example, that happens? Do you need to stop the surgery or do you go forward with the surgery or how does it, do you have anything? Or
so if you look at the numbers, about 1% of patients who have surgery from the front will have a vascular issue, so mm-hmm. like bleeding, yeah, right? And yeah. that's the most feared complication. Fortunately, 1% is pretty darn low. Mm-hmm. It's not zero. If you look at those people who had that 1%, the vast majority of them, like 99% of those, the problem is fixed without an ongoing issue, mm-hmm. right? So how do we deal with it if it happens in the operating room? Well, sometimes there are these tiny little things. And basically, the approach surgeon just fix it or you wait a little while and the body just takes care of it. But if it's severe enough, then it can result in the need for additional surgery or, you know, there's all these endovascular procedures and things like that. But fortunately, you know, those things are very, very unlikely to happen, especially if you're selective in who you operate on.
My mom actually had that procedure, but back in Europe, I'm from Hungary, back in 2011, and they actually snapped her vena cava three times.
No.
So they fixed it, second time fixed it again, and the third time was a disaster. And unfortunately, and that's why I do all this, because that encouraged me, you know, to do the podcast and everything. And she never went through with the surgery. They kept her in a coma after, you know, like 4 days. It was a huge,
oh my goodness,
huge thing. But that was back in 2011. And she was that 1%. And it's unfortunate, but that's what's happened. And I was curious if you have any guidelines, what do you do, you know?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is selecting patients beforehand, mm-hmm. and we're very cautious at looking on their MRI mm-hmm. before surgery, where their vessels are, the anatomy mm-hmm. of the vessels. If there's some people get calcification in the mm-hmm. vessels, just like you can get calcification in your coronary arteries, you can get them in the vessels in front of the spine too. And if patients have a lot of those calcifications, they're higher risk, and we'll just pick another way of doing mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. But I will say that for accessing certain levels of the spine, it's my preferred method of getting there if a fusion is necessary. And the other thing you mentioned is disc replacement. So disc replacement is a way that we can remove the entirety of a disc. And that can be helpful with, you know, pinched nerves and things like mm-hmm. that, sciatica. But it can also, especially in the low back, be used. So disc replacement is applicable in the neck and the low back. Mm-hmm. In the neck, it's usually used for people with pinched nerves. And oftentimes pinched nerves causing, you know, arm pain that's not accessible by just a clean out. And as a result, you have to remove the disc, but instead of fusing the bones together, you put a disc replacement in that maintains your motion. In the low back, that's applicable as well. And in the low back, we often use disc replacements for back pain in very certain situations. So you heard me say, like, very rarely do I suggest surgery mm-hmm. for back pain. But in patients with back pain coming from the discs, not mm-hmm. from arthritis in the joints in the back, so these are usually younger patients, mm-hmm. say, again, 50 and below-ish, mm-hmm. Who have disc-related pain. So it's usually pain worse with sitting, with bending, and lifting. Not as much with standing or leaning back, because that's usually arthritis pain. And if they have a limited number of bad discs, so we can't do it if every disc is bad, but one or two bad discs, these patients are often good candidates for disc replacement, which again involves removing that disc and placing a spacer in, almost like a little knee replacement. And the key there is it maintains their motion. Although if you have a fusion in your neck or your low back, you don't really notice the decrease in your range of motion. Patients often think like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be like the Tin Man or something. I'm not going to be able to move like a robot. Actually, a one-level fusion, you don't notice the difference. But the reason you don't notice the difference is because you make up for it elsewhere. So it transfer those forces to the levels above and below, and then you can have an increase in the deterioration of those levels. So one of the reasons that I try to avoid fusion, if possible, is that I don't want that patient down the line to have this domino effect. One fusion, then another fusion, then another fusion. And what we know about disc replacement is it can, you know, resolve certain types of problems without creating those downstream effects. So if you look at, say, lumbar disc replacement in the low back, and you compare that to fusion in the low back, the rates of having a problem at the levels adjacent, above or below, are 17 times higher with a fusion than a disc replacement.
Wow.
And so I say motion is lotion, right? So we try to keep people moving if at all possible.
Yeah. You mentioned bad disc. Can you explain what a bad disc is?
Yeah. So the kind of technical term for it is disc degeneration or degenerative disc disease. And again, those discs are the shock absorbers in the spine. And in some patients, they can have deterioration of those discs. So they tend to lose some of the water content, which is part of the cushioning ability. And then over time, they start to lose their height. And there's a lot of little nerve endings in these discs. And you can get little tears in the back of the disc called annular fissures. All of this can cause pain. And so, you know, those patients, if they're an appropriate candidate, could be a candidate for disc replacement type surgery.
Okay, thank you for explaining that.
But just like everything else we talked about, a lot of people have disc degeneration and they don't know it. So it's all about listening to the patient, doing that exam, and then correlating it with their MRI.
Yeah. What should people expect in terms of recovery and long-term outcomes?
From which surgery?
I don't know.
We can go through all of them.
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah. So, you know, spine surgery goes from all the way from the ultra-minimally invasive kind of clean out surgeries, endoscopic surgery, which I'm particularly passionate about.
So probably endoscopic surgery, they have better, faster recovery.
Unbelievably so. So my kind of ultra niche, I do minimally invasive stuff and really endoscopy. And what endoscopy is using a camera. So rather than opening up the spine so that we can peer down with our eyeballs, it's making a dime-sized incision and then inserting a long, narrow camera that just goes between the muscle fibers and doesn't disrupt them. And then I watch the whole surgery on a big screen and I can take pressure off of nerves. So whether that's removing disc herniations or bone spurs or arthritis to alleviate sciatica or pain, I can do it in the neck too, pain down the arm. These surgeries usually take about an hour on average. Patients wake up afterwards and it's so rewarding because this crushing sciatica that they've been struggling for with some patients for years or more is usually dramatically better, if not gone, when they wake up in the recovery room. They tell me they have a little soreness in their back, but that's how they describe it. Oh, it's sore, but they're just thrilled that their leg or their arm feels so much better. I do this on an outpatient basis, so there's no overnight stay. They're usually in and out of the hospital, you know, within a couple of hours. There's no back brace or anything like that. We give them a little bit of light pain medication just in case, but a lot of people just take Tylenol or even nothing after this. And so it's just like such a dramatic departure and a paradigm shift from the traditional way that spine surgery has been done. And I'm, you know, we're really kind of, you know, pushing this in a positive direction. And there's a really small cohort of us in the country that do a lot of this type of surgery. But that's changing. And just like if someone told you they were going to do an open rotator cuff repair on you now or an open meniscectomy, you'd be like, take a hike. I'm getting my second opinion with somebody who's going to do it with a scope. I think that 10, 20 years from now, we're going to look back at spine surgery in 2025 and say, look how barbaric this stuff was. You know, I'm not letting somebody open me up. Yeah. Let's just scope it. Yeah. Because patients bounce back so quickly. So, you know, I'll have patients at the gym the day after surgery. I had a woman, very nice lady who a lot of patients travel in for this because there's not, again, a lot of us that do this. So she flew in the day before we did surgery. She flew home the next day, but that night she was excited to go out to some restaurants in Dallas. So she had spine surgery in the morning, discharged, like I think it was early afternoon, went to dinner at a restaurant in Dallas, like a fancy restaurant. And the waiter didn't even know she'd had spine surgery that day.
Wow.
So it's just a marked departure like people think like, oh my God, I'm going to be like in bed or something that. That's not what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Before surgery, doctors say it's important to keep moving, right? How does moving before surgery help people get better faster?
Yeah. So we call it prehab. So even if I know someone is probably going to need surgery, I think it's really beneficial for them to do some exercise and do some physical therapy type stuff before, because we know that the more optimized you are before surgery, within reason, I can't ask people to go run a marathon, right? That's never going to happen. But the more optimized they are, the easier the recovery is after surgery. And we have nice data that shows that the more active people are before, they tend to do the best after surgery. And so you got to listen to your body and not absolutely torture yourself. But again, this goes back to not prescribing bed rest, right? I tell patients, I want you to be as active as you can be and as you can tolerate, even leading up to surgery, because it's highly unlikely you're going to make yourself structurally worse. Usually, by the way, spine injuries don't come from a big traumatic event, right? Usually this
if it's a fracture.
Right. Trauma, that kind of stuff. But most, you know, what we call degenerative wear and tear type stuff, disc herniations, sciatica, stenosis, it just kind of comes out of the blue. And so for me, like to hold people back, they're just as likely to sneeze the next day as cause them a problem this day. So they might as well do stuff that we know is good for them, which is like, you know, light, low impact aerobic exercise, and especially core strengthening type activities. So, you know, I always say that, you know, the spine is a mechanical structure. So the more weight you have pushing down, the more it's going to have a problem. So maintaining a healthy weight is super important. And then the stronger you have your core, it's like an internal back brace, and that lifts you up and can take some pressure off of these structures. So those are the type of exercises that I recommend for people to do.
Yeah. So don't start exercising after a car accident.
If you're in a trauma, that's a different thing.
Don't go to the gym. Okay. So your website says that moving early while healing is important. And I think we just touched based on that. Can you explain a little bit why after the surgery is also important?
The number, well, not, I don't know, a very common concern after surgery for surgeons is not that patients move too much, but instead that they move too little, because a lot of complications after spine surgery are due to the fact of patients not moving. And with traditional spine surgeries, which really do put people in bed, those complications can be higher. What are we talking about? Blood clots, right? The reason you get blood clots a lot of the times is because your blood pools in your legs or elsewhere, and you're not moving enough. And by moving, you pump that blood, and it's less likely to clot. So those blood clots can cause clots in the legs, clots can go to the lungs, strokes, etc. So I want my patients moving. The other thing is like pneumonia, even if you know, pressure sores if you have big surgeries. So the whole goal is to get people moving. Even if they have big surgeries, the goal still is to get them moving, but you're somewhat impaired in your ability to do so if they have some massive surgery. But the beauty of these less invasive surgeries is my patients all are up walking around, even my fusion patients, the day of surgery. And the vast majority of them walk out the door of the hospital and home, the fusion patients, the next day. And so by getting them moving, we not only have them more functional more quickly, but you decrease a lot of these complications that people get.
And at the end of the day, that's why we want to get you know, people and help them to get better because we want them to move, right?
That's right.
That's the goal, to get moving and live your life the way you want to live your, without, you know, being afraid to move.
That's right. Yeah. So kinesophobia, fear of movement, is a real thing. And, and a lot of these patients almost get like a PTSD because, you know,
they're so scared
to move. But it's counterproductive, and we've got to give them the confidence to move. Mm-hmm. We've got to give them the skills to be able to. And sometimes that comes from surgery followed by non-surgical things, and sometimes that's just non-surgical. But what I tell my patients, regardless, no matter what surgery I do, once they recover from that surgery, I have no restrictions on their activities. Like, the whole purpose of doing this is so that they can move.
Just don't go from zero to run a marathon,
that's
right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So gradual is the operative term.
Usually people make a mistake. They feel good and then they go, and from not exercising, they go the opposite direction. They go 7 times, 2 hours a day, and then...
Yeah, they can hurt themselves and not even their spine. I tell patients, like, I don't want you to pop your Achilles or hurt your bicep. Some of these people are very deconditioned leading up to surgery because they've been so limited. And so we need to gradually ramp them back up.
Yeah, graded exercise. So for people who have had back surgery and feel better, why is it still important? We just touched based on that. It's important to move. Do you see that many people who need back surgery don't move enough?
Yes, I think most people don't move enough. You know, if
define enough anyway, right? I mean,
yeah, you know, that's hard. I don't know that I have like an absolute number, but I would say
we have the guidelines from the World Health Organization.
Right, how step much, counts and stuff like that.
How much we're supposed to move, 2 to 3 times a week?
Right, 150 minutes of
300
of moderate exercise a week. Yeah, those guidelines can be very helpful, but usually more is better. And and I think if as a culture we moved more, then I would be out of business, and I would be happy because I'm magnanimous like that. But it's hard, you know. We're all busy, especially if you live in a place that's more of a car culture than a walking culture. People just don't get those steps in, and it's important to be, you know, deliberate about getting that exercise in. And it doesn't have to be high intensity exercise. So there's the big craze right now is zone 2 exercise. So, you know, your heart rate's not as high, but even if you can walk at a reasonable pace, then that's really good for you. And it's certainly way better than doing nothing.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. Now, how does not moving make back pain worse?
Yeah, because people stiffen up. And so, you know, if you think about arthritis, anywhere in the body, knees, hips, shoulders, back. If you don't move, those joints, they really stiffen up. And then patients often say, yeah, first thing in the morning or after I sit for a long period of time, I get up and I'm in excruciating pain. And then I kind of warm up a little bit.
As the day goes by.
It gets a little bit better. Maybe not perfect, but it improves. And so if we can keep those people moving, we keep their joints lubricated, and that stiffening up doesn't happen as much. And if you take it to the far extreme, if you don't move, that stiffness gets worse. And then you don't move because the stiffness is worse and the pain is worse. And you get into this vicious cycle where you become less and less and less mobile. And we got to break people out of that cycle.
I think there is even a research. They put some people in bed rest for 2 weeks and they got back pain.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's how I feel about neck braces and back braces, by the way, either after surgery or in general. Like, I tell my patients that I prefer that they never wear a neck brace or a back brace.
There is a research on that one too. I just read it. They actually don't recommend a back brace anymore.
Which is...
if you had surgery, I'm not sure, but...
most studies show even with surgery that the back brace doesn't do anything. And so my philosophy is, if I'm doing surgery and I need a back brace to hold together what I did in surgery, then I need to do a better job in surgery. But along those lines, like, a neck brace, people hate wearing a neck brace. And if you took somebody who didn't even have a neck problem and put them in a neck brace for 6 weeks, they would have miserable neck pain at the end of that period of time. And so the whole key is to figure out either a surgical or a non-surgical solution that allows them to move early. within reason, right? Graduated. I don't want my patients, you know, jumping on a pogo stick the day after surgery, but they can all do low impact activities. So they can walk, they can elliptical, they can stationary bike as soon as they want to. And that's because I want to keep things moving.
Within pain tolerance.
That's correct. Yeah.
Are there any advances in surgical techniques that improve outcomes?
Yeah, so for me, it's all this minimally invasive stuff. And again, that's all about preserving the soft tissues. So there are a variety of different minimally invasive techniques that extend all the way from fusion to the ultra minimally invasive clean out endoscopic spine decompressions that I do. But they're really changing spine surgery. And unfortunately, they're not applicable every single time. But they're applicable the vast majority of times. And so for patients who are exploring spine surgery, I encourage them to ask their surgeon if they employ these techniques. And if they don't, or if they're not being recommended, why not?
And how have minimally invasive procedures changed back surgery?
Yeah, well, it's made recovery so much easier in the vast majority of these patients. And so it's funny, my grandfather, who passed away a couple of years ago, but he had a microdiscectomy or a discectomy type surgery back, I want to say in the 60s or something.
Wow.
And he had an incision on his back, one level, one disc, that was like this long.
Wow.
And he was in the hospital for 3 weeks. And my grandfather was a tough guy. You know, he was not a complainer. He was in the hospital for 3 weeks after a surgery that now I do through a dime-sized incision. It takes an hour and they're at the gym less than 24 hours later. And so this is how we're really revolutionizing what we're able to do and the outcomes for patients.
That's amazing. What is the most common procedure you do?
The most common procedure that I do are clean out type procedures. So it's interesting that you asked this question. I just saw an article on the most common procedures in the United States across all spine surgeons. And the substantial number one was spinal fusion surgery, which I was appalled by. Again, I do spinal fusions. I do them sparingly, right? So like I probably did 25 spine surgeries this month and two were fusions. So, you know, if you're thoughtful and you try to avoid these things, then you can in the vast majority of the situation. So for me, by far, it's these clean out type operations, which are so rewarding to me because, you know, patients just have such immediate relief and I'm not creating all these downstream effects.
What innovations are on the horizon?
Yeah, so there's a lot of exciting things. I'm excited about spine surgery.
That's good. Let's talk about it then.
Yeah, so there are innovations in a couple different domains. So one of them is diagnostic. So helping us figure out exactly where the problem's coming from. And I think that part of that will be AI, machine learning, and helping us with decision making. So we talk about the art of medicine, and a lot of it's still an art, you know, trying to get a feel for where this problem's coming from, what is the best option for this patient, how they're going to do, are they going to get better with X, Y, and Z? And I think that as these decision-making tools progress, that they'll be able to give us some guidance, say, hey, this person with a disc herniation that's had pain for 1 week, they're 95% chance of getting better without surgery. Well, then we go down a certain course. Or this patient has a 95% chance of needing surgery. Well, then that's a different conversation. Maybe we don't, you know, go through months of physical therapy and things like that because we're just torturing them unnecessarily. And the ability to stratify patients would be really helpful. And I think that that's coming. Then there are kind of surgical techniques. And there's a lot of cool things that are in the works. So we're doing this endoscopic stuff. But you know, we're going to be able to use the endoscope to do more and more complex operations over the course of time. And that's something that I'm passionate about and we're figuring that out. And then I think there's the recovery side of things too, really optimizing, physical therapy and exercise plans to the individual patient with the individual problem will be beneficial as well. And then there's all these kind of cool things, augmented reality and robotics. And those are like the nerdy things that we do in the operating room, which I think will continue to hone what we're able to do. But yeah, it's an exciting time. I feel like we're in an inflection point with spine surgery where we're kind of stagnant for a really long time, just doing the same thing, same thing. And now there's a lot of kind of, you know, folks that are really passionate about pushing it to the next level.
Enlightenment, right?
Yeah.
Do you think using too many medical interventions can lead to chronic back pain? Too soon, I mean. You know, if they push the patient too soon to surgery.
Yeah, you know, and my goal is to help them avoid surgery, right? And especially because we know that surgery in many cases is not beneficial for isolated back pain. I don't want those patients pushed to surgery regardless. You know, the worst is when I see somebody who comes into my office, they've already had screws and rods up and down their back. And I asked them why they had surgery. They said for back pain. And then I said, well, is your back pain better? And they say, no, it's way worse. And like, that breaks my heart because then it's too late. There's nothing I can do for that patient a lot of the times. Ideally, they come to me before they've undergone that surgery and I can talk them out of that. So yeah, it's really a matter of helping those people avoid that and giving them evidence-based guidelines on what we can do to legitimately help them feel better without some massive intervention. And I can understand where they're coming from, right? Like they just want to feel better.
Of course.
And their pain is massive and like something just needs to be done. But just because you can do a surgery doesn't mean that you should do a surgery and that it's in the patient's best interest.
Yeah, I agree with that. Some people say you can just throw your back out and a chiropractor can fix it right away. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so patients,
let's talk about that.
Patients do, you know, throwing your back out, that's kind of a colloquial term. It's not a medical term. But what they're describing is what we call chronic intermittent low back pain, which is usually happens over the course of time. People are prone to this. And usually they might not have much, if any, back pain, but they get these giant spikes, these intermittent, horrible episodes where they throw their back out. Sometimes they call it like I slipped a disc or something.
Yes. Disc don't really slip.
No, they
They're
don't.
They're not like soap in the,
right, nothing,
in the shower.
Nothing sliding around in your back. Like if it was, you'd have a real problem.
Yeah.
It wouldn't come and go, right? But what's probably happening is they get these inflammatory episodes and it can happen for a variety of reasons. So I mentioned earlier, you can get these little cracks in the disc called annular fissures. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're so small that you can't even see them on MRI, but it lets a little bit of the chemicals from the inside of the disc spill out. And those chemicals are extremely inflammatory. Or sometimes you get, you know, people with arthritis in the back of the spine, they just get inflamed and everything gets inflamed. So the nerves can hurt. They can have pain shooting down their legs. The muscles in the back of the spine, they lock up and they just have so much pain. And so that's throwing their back out. And sometimes it's initiated by, you know, I was lifting a heavy couch, frequently like simultaneous bending and heavy lifting, which by the way, is probably in no one's best interest. So you should have good form when you lift, lift with your legs, not with your back. And when you bend and lift simultaneously, it loads the discs in the front of your spine, like substantially more.
I can argue with that.
Oh yeah.
Because it's not the form but the load.
That's right.
It's not the form because your form would be different if you lift with 100 pounds or 300 pounds. Because your form changes because of the load.
That's right. No, I agree with
or
that.
Or if you lift without any weight, then your form is definitely different than lifting with weight.
That's true. But even if you lift heavy weight with good form, it puts a lot of pressure on your discs.
Absolutely.
Especially if you're forward, right? So there's a whole craze about deadlifts and Olympic lifting and things like that. Not that I'm totally against them. And I love to work out. I still work out a lot. But I've eliminated heavy Olympic lifts from my workout regimen because it just puts your discs at a disadvantage. But nonetheless, if you throw your back out, what the evidence shows is that one, it's probably going to get better over time. There is some evidence that shows that chiropractic care can reduce that amount of time. So it's not wrong to think about chiropractic as part of the overall treatment regimen.
Absolutely.
When that happens. But other things that have been shown to help, we talked about anti-inflammatory medications. If there's no medical reason, you can't take them. Massage can be very helpful because there's that, you know, the muscle spasm. And then moving as, you know, therapeutic exercise. And fortunately, those episodes tend to go away over time. And then it's really a matter of preventing them going forward. I mentioned smoking earlier in our conversation. A lot of people know that smoking is bad for their health, their heart, their lungs, et cetera. But not as many patients know that smoking is actually really bad for your spine.
Exactly.
What it does is it decreases the blood flow to the joints and the discs. And by the way, the blood flow to the discs in the best case scenario is not very good. And so you want to maximize that blood flow and things like nicotine. And it's actually the nicotine in smoking. It's not just the smoking itself. So unfortunately, you can't just like switch to nicotine gum or vaping. Those things are bad also. But that nicotine decreases the blood flow and decreases the body's ability to heal and increases the likelihood of having back problems. So stopping smoking. If you needed an extra boost, don't smoke or use nicotine if you want your back to be in good shape.
This is your sign, right, today. Now, what advice do you have for someone considering back surgery?
Yeah, I would say make sure that you've gotten educated on all of your options. And that's all the way from non-surgical things to the nuances of whatever specific surgery is being offered to you. And if possible, really exhaust the non-surgical things before you go in for surgery. And then do your research, which means, you know, potentially get multiple opinions. This is a decision you're going to have to live with for the rest of your life. And so really doing your research on the surgeon that's going to be doing the procedure, look them up online, you know, see what they've put out there, see what their training is and what other patients have experienced from them, and then see what kind of vibe you get. Because, you know, it's really a team. It's not you really have to jive with your surgeon. You know, what happens during that hour, those hours in the operating room is only one part of it. It's a relationship that you're building. And that recovery period is really important. And you've got to have somebody that you feel comfortable with is going to be a good teammate with you, not just during the surgery and immediate recovery, but the rest of your life. You know, we often say that we don't cure spines, we manage spines because there's many, many discs and many, many joints in the spine. And you try to do the least you can at any given time, but there's no fix for everything. We're all going to get a year older every year. And you want a relationship with somebody that you get along with and trust in the event that something were to happen down the line.
That's what I recommend to my clients as well.
Yeah, perfect.
You know, they can
like-minded.
Exactly. If you don't like me, if you don't like my vibe, well, you know, we have to work together as a team. So you better have a good relationship with that person.
That's right. That's right.
Now, what questions should they ask their doctor?
I would say, what are the alternatives? And then if their doctor is a surgeon, so, you know, say you're thinking about surgery, a key question is, how many of these surgeries do you perform? And there's a lot of evidence that shows that the number of surgeries that they do of a given surgery is reflective of the outcomes with that surgery. So you don't want to be going to get a lumbar disc replacement with somebody that's only done, you know, three in the past 5 years. You want to go, and we have some, we published on this, high volume centers tend to be better at this, right? And so just asking that surgeon, hey, is this something you do all the time? Or is this something that you're going to be like reading through a textbook the night before trying to figure out how to do it? And if that's the case, it might be worth traveling somewhere, which is really a center of excellence for the problem that you're getting. You know, it's worth traveling for spine surgery. This is something that you're going to have to live with forever. And you really want the person doing it to be like the person for that problem. And by the way, a little plug for our practice, Texas Back Institute. You know, we're one of the largest spine specific practices in the world. And what that allows us to do is get really niche about whatever little thing we do. So I don't have to be a generalist that takes care of everything. You know, if you have a trauma or a tumor or something like that in your spine, I am not mm-hmm. your guy. Like,
yeah.
But regardless of who you come into, I have partners who are world experts on that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I just work you up and get you the right mm-hmm. person and vice versa. If you come into them and you've got, you know, something that's amenable mm-hmm. to these little tiny yeah. outpatient surgeries that I do, then they make sure that, mm-hmm. that you get to me. And those kind of environments are really beneficial to patients because they know that they're getting the best care that they possibly can.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. And how can they make an informed decision?
Yeah, I think it's really weighing all of the options, getting multiple opinions if necessary. Reading on the internet, although you got to be careful with this. So giant caveat here that, you know, if you ask ChatGPT or, you know, you just Google around mm-hmm. or look on TikTok, you know, the quality mm-hmm. of that information,
Instagram
is not routinely good. Mm-hmm. But there are some sites and places where you can get good information looking at, say, society. So we have these different societies, Society of Neurosurgeons, Society mm-hmm. of American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. They put out patient-directed information that's evidence-based and vetted. And so just making sure that what you read on the internet is coming from a reputable source mm-hmm. is important mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. Have you ever had back pain?
I've had back pain, but not above the normal type mm-hmm. back pain. So, you know, I, like any human, I feel like back pain is a part of being alive. Nobody can have no pain ever, but fortunately I'm very careful and my genetics are such, we didn't talk about genetics, but genetics plays into back problems yeah. as well. That, you know, if I did some heavy gardening and yard work mm-hmm. yesterday, yeah, my back's a little sore. Every once in a while, I'll take an Advil and that's the end of it. But, you know, I see enough patients with back pain that I'm super, super conscientious about what I do with my spine.
Yeah. So you just did too much too soon with the gardening then.
That's
you
probably know, that true. Was, I should have eased into it.
Exactly. You know, don't do that, yeah, listeners. Don't do what Dr. Derman just did.
It's spring. Spring is coming. It's in beautiful Texas. Outside. I couldn't resist myself.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening to the Back to Movement podcast. That's all for today, folks. See you next time.